from the Portland Sports Arena. This is Portland Wrestling.
And this is a very special edition of the Portland WrestleCast. I'm Jim Valley. Well, it's Hall of Fame season. I hope you have your ballot for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Now, 2 years ago, I did a show like this talking about the credentials for voting for Don Owen for the Hall of Fame. And to my surprise, he came within 2 votes of getting in. And for years, Don Owen never got that close. And I was happy and sad about it. On one hand, obviously very happy that he did so well. On the other hand, you know, sad that he didn't get in, but I was actually surprised that he did so well. I expected that show to sort of be the first salvo in working toward getting Don into the Hall of Fame, and that would just lay the groundwork. Well, it turned out that that show did much more influence than I expected. On the other hand, you know, the past few years I've been sick and have been unable to really lobby on a consistent basis for Don Owen. And last year, he fell shorter. He did fine, but I think he came within 15 votes. So this year, with this show, I'm hopeful to make up the difference and then some to get him in to the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. And joining me now is former wrestler, current promoter, and Northwest historian, Matt Farmer.
Hello, everybody. Hey, Jim. Good to be on the show again. And, you know, I might have been, I could have been blamed maybe for him not getting in 2 years ago because there were times during that telecast where I wasn't necessarily complimentary of Don. So I think this time I'll be a little more complimentary of him. Like, my relationship with Don Owen is a little weird. It's a little strange from different eras because I have so many mutual friends that worked with Don that sometimes their bias towards him has skewed maybe my thought process in his Hall of Fame induction or not. I don't know. Maybe I'm guilty of that. Because there's times that I'm on the fence of whether I think he's a Hall of Fame worthy promoter or not. I will tell you this, though. This year, one of the reasons I am going to vote for Don, and it's something that has really struck a chord with me this year, because I've talked to a few people, and even recently, as a few days ago, received tweets from different people when I'd asked them their opinions about Don, and it's the longevity. You know, really, when you take a look at it, the longevity is what puts him over the top as a promoter. Sure, he never set the world on fire in terms of large crowds that he drew. He was never putting his audience in front of, you know, in basketball size arenas on a regular basis. He wasn't doing that. But he was consistent with the same towns. I mean, you're talking about towns like Portland and Eugene and Salem, which were not big towns, but he ran them every single week consistently and drew good crowds. I mean, you're talking a couple thousand people every single week to some of these buildings. And doing it for 60 plus years is just amazing. I mean, nobody does that today, the side of Salvador Luderoth, you know, or the Luderoth family. And it's just, if that's not Hall of Fame worthy for longevity, I don't know what else would be.
60 years is an incredible time.
Yes.
Especially when you think that, relatively speaking, he's responsible for the vast majority of that 60 years. I mean, yes, his dad started it, but his dad passed away when Don was a relatively young man.
Yeah, very much so. He passed away in 1941. And, you know, here's the thing. Herb was a very successful promoter in his own right who promoted for 20 years. Who had that longevity himself, you know?
Yeah.
The thing, when you compare Don to other promoters, the promoters that are in, many of those promoters only had really strong handful of years, and then they were out of business shortly thereafter. Like, you look at someone like Bill Watts, for instance. His run as a promoter was 10 years, maybe, before he had to sell out because his business was tanking. So, you know, and I realize that Bill's not in just as a promoter, but if you think about that, you know, he did draw some great crowds, but at the same time, it was a short period of time. It was just, a pimple on the career that Don Owen had as a promoter.
Well, and people say Don was the one who lasted longer after Jerry Jarrett. And that's true. You know, it was Don who went, and then Jerry was pretty much the last territory standing. But really, had Don probably scaled back his operation and paid what Jarrett paid, Don probably would have stayed in business. I mean, some of the guys were still, you know, they weren't rich, but they were able to, you know, survive to a degree. You know, the top guys were anyway, but, you know, Don got out of business when some of the people were still able to make a living.
Yeah, and another thing, it's hard to compare the two as well, because Don was in his 80s by that time, or close to 80 years old, you know, and Don also was a very rich person, way wealthier than people understood, and he'd already been promoted. Like, you know, he had been in the bit wrestling game since, you know, birth. So by the time he was 80, he was ready to retire. I think even if the business was going strong, he was going to step down anyways.
Yeah, I think you're probably
right.
You know,
within relative time, because he had talked about that for years, where he just wanted to go back on his farm and work there, you know.
Yeah, for those who don't know, Don was a very wealthy cattle rancher.
Yeah, there was and real estate owner as well. There was a period of time where legend has it that he owned like more square footage in the city of Eugene than anybody else in the city. So, you know, he was a wealthy person.
I want to also talk about one of the things that I don't think I really quite grasped that I learned over the time I've done the Portland WrestleCast is Don, while he wasn't, you know, Buddy Rose or Dutch as far as necessarily running the dressing rooms and things, but he had more of a hand in booking things and directions of things than I realized. I thought he was less involved than he was.
Now, yeah, see, that's the thing that, here's the thing that, like, if you look at Portland and you look at the history, and I'm talking about the long history of Portland, their booking formula was pretty consistent from the 40s until he went out of business, which means to me, he had a certain formula in place and he let those wrestlers or bookers come in and kind of like fill in the gaps, right? But he still had his formula of how he liked things to handle. You know, it's like, why did a lot of the big baby faces or heels come into the territory and their big move was the full Nelson? Because that's something that Don wanted, right? So when those guys like a Buddy Rose or a Dutch Savage came into the territory, Don would set those guidelines in place and say, hey, this is how I like it ran. Now you come up with some unique ideas to throw in there to add to it, right? And that's what a lot of promoters would do. So I imagine that's what Don did. And I mean, hit formula, the same formula that Don would run, where he would bring in the young baby face and team him with a heel, or I'm sorry, they'd bring in like a young heel and team him with an older heel, and then they would turn on each other. That was a storyline that he repeated numerous times and led to big business in a lot of the cases, you know, and that was something that he did back in the 50s.
Yeah, I mean, so, you talk about the full Nelson, just off the top of my head, in my fandom, Jesse Ventura did it. Snuka, I think, did it.
Yes.
Mike Masters did it. Billy Jack, obviously. Kevin Kelly, who was Nails, he came in after Billy Jack and did it. Ricky Vaughn, Lance Von Erich did the full Nelson. That's what, 7-8 guys I just listed off over the course of 10 years.
Jesse Ventura and Bull Ramos also used that move when he first came into the territory.
Yeah, Bull did too.
And, you know, that goes back for years. You know, like when Lonnie Mayne and Tony Bourne broke up, that was a formula that they had used previous to that as well. So it's like, you know, a very formula with the booking, a lot like Vince McMahon Sr. had a formula that he took from promoters that he worked with and carried it on through the years and just added different names to it. You know, it's the mega powers breaking up. That was a storyline that his dad had used to great success before Vince Jr.
Well, and you talk about Lonnie Mayne and Tony Bourne, you know, they drew like 8,000 to the Portland Coliseum in like 1968, I think it was.
Yeah, you know, and here's another interesting fact about that is a few weeks later, they drew another crowd of about 7,000 fans for the rematch. So, you know, in a month period of time, I think one was like March 5th, one was like March 25th, something like that, they drew, you know, a respectable 15,000 fans, you know, in a small town of Portland in just those two shows, you know. So that was big business for that time frame for this area.
And that's one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on. Oftentimes, when people think about a promotion, they focus on the end of it. WCW, AWA, UWF, Crockett. And so a lot of people just think about the 80s and very early 90s when it comes to Portland. But what I wanted to talk about is years where Don drew very well that people don't know about or don't talk about.
Yeah, very much. And this is something that I, as a Northwest historian, am often at odds with people that reminisce about the Portland territory because, you know, and this is just because of the age that we're in, and the people that would be reminiscing would be our age or a little bit older. Well, not our age, my age, and the olders like yourself and others of that older age group. They would be reminiscing about the time when they were young, which would have been in the 60s or 50s in your case, but the 60s or 70s or 80s, right? That's when you would reminisce about the glory days. But the truth was, is by the mid-1980s, Portland was no longer in its glory days. Its glory days were the 40s, the 50s, the 1960s when their business was their hottest. So the Roddy Pipers and Buddy Roses and Jesse Venturas, they missed the glory period of Portland wrestling. It's just to the fans that were around in that area, it's the glory days to them. But the business was much hotter in the Northwest in the 60s than it was in the 70s, by far.
Talk about some of the crowds that he drew.
The Portland Memorial Coliseum, I don't know exactly what date it opened, but it opened in the early 1960s, and Don, by, you know, 1961, was running shows at the Memorial Coliseum. I think his first one was in 1961, and it was Pat O'Connor versus Lou Thesz, and it didn't draw very well. It drew, you know, what they probably could have put into the Portland Armory. But here's the thing about Portland at the time, is Don Owen ran Portland twice a week, every Friday night at the Labor Temple, and then he ran his big show every Monday night at the Portland Armory. Portland Armory would sell out at about 3,000 people, maybe 3,500, and it was common for them to sell out. So, you know, Monday nights having 3,000 people in the Portland Armory in Portland, Oregon in the 1960s was a pretty good sized crowd because Portland was not a big city. And they would, you know, the next night they would be in Salem, which is just, you know, under an hour drive away. So there was a lot of wrestling in just a short period, short regional area. And So, you know, they were drawing a lot of fans per, you know, per ticket every week to wrestling. So they would do these occasional events at the Memorial Coliseum, and they had some good crowds of, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people. Sometimes they would dip down to 3,000, but, you know, they would bring in like Curtis Iaquea and wrestle Tony Bourne, and they would they'd draw 5,000 fans, which is a good crowd. Or they would have like Buddy Rogers versus Billy White Wolf and draw 4,000 or 5,000 fans, you know. Or, you know, Maurice Mad Dog Vachon would come in and wrestle, and they would draw 7,000 or 8,000 fans, which, you know, that's a good crowd for Portland. So there were periods of times when he did draw larger than average crowds in Portland. Two shows every single week. So you got a Friday night show and you got a Monday night show. So, I mean, that's a lot of wrestling in, you know, so if you're averaging 5,000 fans every week in one city, that's a good number of fans, especially when you consider 52 weeks a year for, you know, 50, 60 years. It's a lot of time and a lot of fans. And there's also things like the city of Eugene, which at there was a period of time in the 40s and 50s when Eugene was the own family's number one city, where they had just a massive string of sellouts to the Eugene Armory and a massive number of times that they ran the Eugene Armory. And that dated back to his, you know, his father's time. There was a period of time where I read that Herbo and his dad, and this is about Herb, of course, not about his son, but where Herb ran a show at the Eugene Armory once a week for 20 years without supposedly missing a show. And what caused him to miss a show was World War II, you know? So that's just amazing when you think about that history of the Owen family running in Portland, because it just it precedes Don as well. Elton was a big part of the Portland territory as well. And, you know, he's kind of a joke today, considered as a joke, but there was a time when Elton Owen was one of the biggest draws as a wrestler in the city of Portland and in Eugene. You know, he had a big money feud with Gorgeous George with Don as the promoter. So it was a big deal, you know. There was the Owen family was definitely well known even in the 40s locally.
That's another thing that we should talk about. Gorgeous George, while he wasn't fully the human orchid yet in Portland, the character did begin in the Portland area under Don Owen.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, Gorgeous George, as George Wagner, I mean, was probably the biggest star in Portland pre-Gorgeous George days. I mean, we're talking late 30s, early 40s here, where George was in the Northwest and drawing great crowds. You know, when he married his wife in Eugene, they drew a sellout, and that was midst of like something like an 8-week string of sellouts to the Eugene Armory, which, like as I said, was like about 3,000 to 3,500 fans every single week. You know, that's good business right there. It was always consistently Portland, Salem, Eugene. It was usually those three cities. That was the Owen family stronghold.
Right.
There were times when Eugene was their main building. That was their main city, was Eugene, because there were periods of time in the 40s and 50s when, or even earlier, dating back to the 20s, where there was a promoter in Portland named Virgil Hamlin, along with his assistant Ted Thye, and they ran the Northwest. They were the Dons of the Northwest. They put everybody into place, and I'm talking about the Northwest from Oregon to Vancouver, British Columbia. And if you were a promoter in that area, they were the ones that were supplying you talent most of the time, unless you were promoting what they called the light heavyweights, which is what the Owen family was doing at the time. They would bring in the lighter weight wrestlers, where Virgil Hamlin and Ted Thye would bring in a lot of like the national stars, like the Ed Lewis's and Jim Lundus's and Jim Browning, you know, guys like that. And the Owen family, they would concentrate on the lighter weight wrestlers the Frank Stojaks and, you know, guys like that, Eddie Williams and some of the big stars of that era. But then Ted would always leave every summer, or I think it was actually every winter, he would leave for Australia and run Australia with Richard Lean, Dick Lean in Australia, who ran the whole country. And then there was a breakup between them and they fell apart, and Don went on his own, and or the Herb and Don went on their own, and they kind of like were rivals for a long period of time. But there was a time in the 40s, mostly 50s and 60s, where there were four offices, booking offices in the Northwest. And so there were periods of time when the Owen family pretty much just stayed in Central Oregon. Once in a while, they would venture up to some of the southern towns in Washington. But up until about, the 50s or 60s, they pretty much just stayed Central Oregon. And that was their towns. And they would book talent out to other cities and other towns for other promoters, like guys like Harry Elliott or Cliff Olson or, you know, Floyd Musgrave or somebody like that. And over time, they gained control of the entire territory, where if you moved in or if you ran a town somewhere in the Northwest, you had to either get their permission or use their office to book talent out of.
You mentioned Harry Elliott, and we've talked a lot about Oregon, but how much credit do you think Don gets for attendance in the state of Washington?
He gets plenty of credit, and he should get plenty of credit. So Harry Elliott was, just for the listeners, he was a very successful promoter for a good 10 years in the state of Washington on his own. But he wasn't really on his own. He had his own office, which was based around the TV deal that he was able to contract with on Cairo Channel 7 in Seattle, which was one of the major networks. He got an hour television show every Saturday, and he based his territory around that television show, which was separate from Don Owens. Now, Harry, because he went all the way back to working with Herb as an assistant to Herb, a referee and a wrestler for Herb, stayed loyal to him for a long period of time and would book talent out of the Owen family's office. So any towns that Harry ran, he would have to pay a percentage to the Owen family and book talent out of there. And then there was a breakup between those guys, and he switched alliances and started booking talent out of Vancouver. Yet in some weird way, Don still had a percentage of the Vancouver office. So in some way, they were still kind of like working together. And Don had control over that. So if Don wanted to cut off talent to Harry Elliott, he could have done that. He could have cut off the NWA and the international talent to Harry Elliott if he wanted to. Probably would have been bad for Don's business himself, because the Seattle office was actually generating more revenue. But, you know, Don deserves credit for, even during a time when they weren't talking, there was literally like a 10-year period where this partner of Don and Harry and Don did not speak to one another. So they remained partners without communicating with each other for a long period of time. So there, Don does deserve some credit for keeping that relationship intact and keeping that revenue. And here's another thing too, is when you're able to book wrestlers, international wrestlers or wrestlers from around the country, the names will come into your territory if they could get those big paydays. And so with Don, if you could offer him Portland, which was a good paying town, you'd have to offer them more than just Salem and Eugene, which were not good paying towns at the time. But if you could offer them Portland and Seattle and maybe another town in Washington that was a good paying town, that was their week. So you were able to attract higher quality, higher level of talent by having those cities running good business at the time. So that's a credit to Don.
Another credit for Don is, by and large, people liked working for him.
They did, you know, and a credit to Don is that he had a reputation and built up a reputation of paying a fair wage, paying a fair percentage of the house. You know, a lot of the East Coast promoters, your Hall of Fame promoters like your Jim Barnett's or your Eddie Graham's or even your Bill Watts may be a little different. They paid a ridiculously low percentage of the house. We're talking 10, 12, 13% of the gate to the crew, where Don paid closer to 30%.
Which and is what you're supposed to pay.
Yeah, you know, they always said publicly that they paid 30 to 35%. Very few of them did. So Don got that reputation, and you know, wrestlers realized that, hey, I could make, you know, $500 a week in Portland, in sleep in my own bed every single night almost, or I could be making $700 a week in a territory where I'm never home and driving 3,000 miles a week, you know. So he did have a reputation for being a good promoter in a territory that had easy drives, you know, and a consistent, loyal fan base that stayed around for years.
That's true. It sounds morbid, but you literally had to wait for someone to pass on before you were able to get their ringside tickets.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, that's always what they said. I know that some of those fans that I remember sitting by were always there, you know. And I remember the first time I was at the Portland Sports Arena sitting behind an older lady, and I brought up a conversation with her, and she said that she'd been going there for 20 years and had been sitting in the same seat for 20 years. So it's like, that's crazy, you know? And it's just crazy.
What about the NWA? How active was Don as a member, picking champions, lobbying for champions? Was he very active?
No. Don, actually, he liked the security of the NWA. He didn't like the NWA. He didn't like Sam Muchnick, number one.
Right, yeah, I know that.
Yeah. He didn't like sending them money, number two. He just did it for the security. That was all. He was part of the National Wrestling Alliance. He was also part of the National Wrestling Association, which had, because of the state commission in Washington and Oregon at the time, they were aligned with the National Wrestling Association, which was tied to the National Boxing Association, which was still a thing into the 70s. And it was actually like a legitimate association for boxers and wrestlers. It really didn't have much power except with some of the commissions. And Don was a member of them too. He just did it for security. And so he could get the opportunity to book champions, their champions once in a while, and give access to him for guys that he would want to bring in. And he was close with some promoters, you know, that were in the NWA. But if it wasn't for that, he wouldn't have cared, you know. He liked being – he didn't want his – Don was the type of promoter that didn't really care if he had press, if he got – articles written about him. In fact, he didn't care for that kind of stuff. He just wanted to keep quiet, run his shows every week, every day, and draw his fans, and that's all that he wanted. He didn't want publicity, you know. He just wanted to do his own thing. He wanted to control his publicity. He's the kind of guy that if one of the toilets clogged up in the Portland Sports Arena, he would probably be in there unplugging it himself. You know, there's that really famous television interview with Don Owens, which is pretty rare, right before his 60th anniversary show, where they go meet Don out at his farm, and he's like in his farming clothes. You know, he didn't care.
He didn't get dressed up for television.
No. And so that was Don. You know, that he was just a different type of a character. His fan base, in his eyes, were blue-collared loggers and steel workers, and you know what I mean. They were the laborers who came to the matches to blow off some steam, and that's all that, you know, that's what they were to him, you know, and that's what he wanted his product to represent, was the people that came to his shows.
And I think it did. I think it very much did.
I agree. Yeah, very much. Yeah. You know, and it's funny because you and I are both from this region. We know what kind of a legacy the wrestlers that Don did present every week had on your average people. You know, you talk about household names, and those wrestlers like a Dutch Savage, everybody knows who Dutch Savage was. Even if they didn't really watch wrestling, they've heard the name, or their dad or their uncles or their grandpa watched wrestling, so they know the name Dutch Savage. The television was a huge success, whether it was in Seattle or Portland. You know, they were drawing huge numbers. There were times where the Saturday Night Show was drawing, you know, something like 70% of the people watching television at the time or something like that. Just huge business, you know. And so if they weren't buying tickets every week, they were following along every week on television. So, you know, Don was synonymous with the culture in that area.
You know, if you go back in the archives, I had Johnny Mantell on. And Johnny Mantell was here in 79-80 when the whole Rose Piper feud was really at its peak. And in Johnny Mantell's opinion, at least he said this, maybe he was just blowing smoke, I don't know. But he did say on the record, you can go back and listen to it, that in his opinion, the Portland television was more influential in this area than the world-class TV was when he was there during the Von Erich peak. And that is quite a statement.
Yeah, I could see that because I would imagine in Dallas they would have more television options.
Yeah.
And there was a lot more entertainment in Dallas than there would have been in Portland at that time. Because in Portland, literally, besides college sports, was the Blazers, you know?
Yeah.
And that's all they had. I mean, in terms of sports entertainment, you know, and having Rose and Piper, I could imagine that television on Saturday nights was just a huge spectacle for people, you know? They might not have been ticket buyers because there was some, maybe in Portland there was that that blue collar feel to it, to where those people that watched on television didn't always go to the shows, but they were watching it.
And you want to talk about the power of Portland television. It used to be that Portland TV started live at 8:30. Well, around 1980 or so, it switched to a tape delay and started at 11 o'clock on Saturday nights in Portland. Well, people watching the show didn't seem to grasp that. They did an angle where Buddy Rose stole Roddy Piper's kilt, took it up to the crow's nest, that's where they did their TV interviews, and set it on fire. Well, people at home saw this, called the fire department, the fire truck shows up, and there's nobody at the Portland Sports Arena. It's dark, because that happened like 3 hours earlier, but that is just the power of Portland television, that people believe that.
That's just crazy, you know, but that's how it was back then. People believed, you know.
Buddy Rose sponged off of that TV and his name for decades.
He did. He really did. You know, like when he threw the Northwest belt off the bridge, you know, there was thousands of, I don't know if thousands, that would be an overestimate, but there were hundreds of people gathered around to watch that, you know. He was a celebrity. I mean, later in life, I became a friend with his, and we would hang out casually at times. And he would get recognized everywhere.
Right.
You know, corner stores. I mean, casinos everywhere. Like anywhere we would go, there was always someone that would recognize him. You know, and they would always bring up something that was in their life that they saw him on that was a big deal to them, you know? So imagine Lonnie Main felt, and fans felt the same about Lonnie Main. An earlier generation felt the same way about guys like Milt Olson, who were huge stars in Oregon in the 40s, you know? It's just crazy, you know, like, We talked before we started recording this, and you were asking about some of the peak periods of Don's career. And I even brought this up here, as well-known and successful as the 1970s were, it was probably really the 50s and 60s that was Don's peak as a promoter in this region. It was just everything was hitting. Everything was doing great business. There were national stars off of national TV that were coming in, and they were drawing great money everywhere, you know, for, you know, when you consider what great money was at the time. Like, I have record business records of what they were doing at the time. And, you know, Gorgeous George would come in for a few weeks in the Portland territory and Washington territory and would make $5,000 or $6,000 a week in these small tank towns, which I remember I did the inflation adjustment and it was like $30,000 in a week, you know, which is what he would have made working the small towns around here because the business was so hot at the time. You know, they were selling out the Cheney Stadium in Tacoma, which was, you know, 5,000 fans, you know, off of the television that they were running off of the territory that Don had set up. So there was big business in a relatively small region.
I'm glad you brought that up because I did want to circle back again and talk about how Don at least had a hand in creating the initial Gorgeous George persona.
I would definitely think so because you see highlights of the Gorgeous George character and you see it increase as time goes on. And I know that the first time he was called Gorgeous George was in television. I mean, not on television, I'm sorry, was in the Eugene area because he was like the local baddie for the longest time. And that was a name they came up with him in like a derogatory term, you know?
Right.
And then he did the face turn and became even a bigger star in the area. And this was before he became the platinum blonde, you know.
The human orchid.
Yeah, the human orchid. This was before then.
Yeah.
So, you know, he was a major star here in the Northwest before he was ever, you know, a big star nationally. You know, one of the things, too, about Don is that guys would come here and get seasoning before they went on to become big stars. And Don was a big proponent of that.
Yeah.
You know, I know in later years, you had guys like Red Bastien, for instance, who booked a lot of different territories. He would purposely send guys to Dallas or from, say, like Dallas to the Northwest because he knew that this is an area where they could be kind of under the covers and get that seasoning, get that experience. If there was potential for them to become breakout stars somewhere. And a lot of people sent, you know, a lot of the promoters would send guys, young prospects to the area too. Portland wasn't an area where they would break in new guys. Like they didn't, what I mean by that is they didn't train guys to wrestle here. They didn't have a training school here, or Don didn't like to break in locals to become wrestlers, but he did like to use guys from other regions who were young and inexperienced, maybe even having no matches, and use them in the area, you know, and get them ready to go on to other areas.
Yeah, Don didn't want homesteaders or competition.
No. Yeah, he was very reluctant to use guys that lived, you know, homesteaders. So, yeah, very reluctant.
But yeah, I mean, just an example that everybody knows, you can see on YouTube videos of Roddy Piper in California, and that's where he first was a headliner. But you can see the difference between Roddy Piper in California headlining versus Roddy Piper in Portland headlining. And I would argue there's less difference between Portland Roddy Piper and Mid-Atlantic Roddy Piper. So I think, you know, you really do, for a lot of people, learn to be that top guy.
Yeah. And that was the thing, is a lot of those young guys would get that opportunity. Rip Rogers used to talk about that a lot, too, is like there's a difference between being a wrestler and being a guy who's a wrestler who could draw money. And you don't learn to make money until you learn to be – you don't learn how to get over until you learn how to put people over. Is like an old saying, in that you have to learn one skill first before you learn the next skill. And that was what Portland was, is you learned how to work with those guys who had already gotten over, or guys that were getting over, and you worked with those guys, and that's how you learned, you know. In a lot of regions, if you were a young person, there was no way you were going to break out of that preliminary role, so you never gained those skills unless you had those opportunities to be put in front of people in a town in a main event situation. So you would never get, you'd never get an opportunity to get those skills without a place like Portland.
So we've talked about his longevity, his drawing, and his influence. But I think there are two other topics that we could discuss that put Don Owen in the Hall of Fame on their own merits. And those are his really sweet suits and his ring announcing.
Yes, yes. Yeah, Don was notoriously known for his lack of announcing skills. Here's the thing that's really interesting about that, and I've talked to a few people that would have had that inside information. Don was a really smart guy. But one of the things that Don was is that he was a complete 100% worker. Everything that he did in front of the fans was a work. So this is something that I was told, was that Don would act, he would put across this impression of not being completely capable as a ring announcer because he wanted fans to believe that there's no way he would have the mental fortitude to tell these wrestlers what to do. I don't know if I got across correctly in what I said, but Don wanted to make himself look dumb so they wouldn't think that he was capable of booking matches.
Wow, well, he is the Daniel Day-Lewis or Christian Bale of crappy ring announcing, man. That's amazing.
So what a lot of the old promoters would do, and this goes back to the carnival barking days, is they would no-sell things.
Well, yeah.
Like Vince does it, but he would no-sell his intelligence. And I don't know how much of that is true or how much of it's not, but that's what I was always told by people that were his contemporaries, you know. I think by the time we saw him on television, too, he was already, you know, pretty advanced in age. So
right. He doesn't care.
He doesn't care. And he'd been doing it for so long, you know. The guy was helping his dad promote the night, you know, Pearl Harbor was bombed, so.
All right, let's wrap this up and make the case that Don Owen has got more longevity than anybody else on the ballot, and more longevity than all but a few people in wrestling history. The other thing is he definitely has influence. He has inspired some of the biggest careers in wrestling, and also many other careers of people who came in with a little experience and immediately went on to greater things once they left Portland. But also, I think we've made the case for drawing. I realize that a lot of people focus on the 80s primarily and the 70s, but there's big drawing cards consistently in the 40s, but much bigger numbers in the 50s and 60s primarily. And even if you take out some of the peaks and only talk about Don drawing to halls and armories and gymnasiums that seated maybe 500 people, we're still talking 500 people a night for 5-7 days a week for 50-60 years. That is a pretty impressive number for drawing.
Yeah, I guess a good analogy would be like this. Like during Triple H's period where he was running NXT and it was the talk of the town and everybody loved it. Well, imagine if that's all Triple H did in his career was run NXT the way he did it as, you know, when it was the talk of the town, but he did it for 50 years. if he ran NXT for 50 years, he would be a Hall of Fame caliber promoter, right? I think he would. That's what Don did.
And if
essentially,
and think about this, NXT down in Florida wasn't drawing 500 people.
No, no. But, you know, and they would do big events that would draw, you know, 10, 12,000 people sometimes.
Right.
Under the right circumstances. But, you know, Don was doing that every day, was running an event every day, sometimes more than once a day, for, you know, 50 plus years, 60 years, you know, in some capacity at least. So that's, you know, that's Hall of Fame worthy.
I think so. Well, for your consideration, I hope you think about putting Don on the ballot when you go to your non-performers and vote for him. And maybe this year will be the year we can get him into the Pro Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Matt,
yes.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate you.
By the way, let's do a plug for your... How can people find out about Defy? What do you have coming up with Defy?
We run events all across the West Coast. We hit Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles on a regular basis. So check us out online. Follow us on social media at defynw.com. You could also check out our shows on defyondemand.com. And then if you want to see it, you know, our website's defywrestling.com, or you could just check us out on social media.
So coming up November 20th is Defy Brutalist featuring Brody King. I believe you said earlier off the air that there was one ticket left for that. However, you do have more shows coming up in January and December. Where could people get tickets for those?
So we got an event coming up December 16th in Los Angeles at the Lodge Room in Highland Park. Tickets go on sale November 19th at 10 a.m. And that show is, so grab tickets for that. We also have a show December 18th, 2 days later in Seattle. That's a Saturday night at Washington Hall. So yeah, I'd highly recommend getting tickets to both events. Los Angeles, we debuted there last month. The show was awesome. We're coming back. Christopher Daniels has already been advertised for it, so it's going to be another good show.
And look for some pretty big events coming up in 2022.
Exactly, yes.
Matt Farmer, thank you so much for your time and fantastic information about Don Owen. And hopefully people will consider voting for Don Owen for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame for 2021. If not, he does fall off the ballot this year. Speaking of this year is also the 30th anniversary of the end of the Portland Wrestling TV show. And hopefully we will be able to do a show talking about that and talking with some of the people who were there at the very end of Portland Wrestling Television. Until then, I'm Jim Valley. This is the Portland WrestleCast, and there's excitement in the air.
So long, everybody. From the Portland Sports Arena, this has been Portland Wrestling.